I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk about voter turnout. The Spirit in Place and Indiana Humanities Groups are working with other Indiana not-for-profits to encourage voter turnout as a way to increase the civic health of Central Indiana. My guests are Spirit in Place Program Director Aaron Kelly, Indiana Humanities Programs and Community Engagement Director Leah Namias, and the Benjamin Harrison Presidential Site President and CEO Charlie Hyde. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881. Email nolimits at wfyi.org. Facebook is No Limits WFYI. Twitter is WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking today about voter turnout, ways we can increase it. The Spirit in Place and Indiana Humanities Groups are engaging with other not-for-profits in a project to increase voter turnout as part of a civic challenge initiative. We're going to talk about that. We're also going to talk about the whole idea of civic health and what constitutes a healthy community, at least in terms of participation and levels of interest in public matters. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. My guests are Aaron Kelly. She is Program Director for Spirit and Place. Leah Namias, who is Director of Programs and Community Engagement for Indiana Humanities. And Charlie Hyde, who is the President and CEO of the Benjamin Harrison Presidential Site, which is also going to be a polling place this year. So I'm going to start because, you know, when people think about voter turnout, they think probably more politically engaged groups that obviously the parties are going to be involved in trying to encourage people to vote and registering them. Avowedly, if not partisan, at least ideological groups such as Move On and some of the other organizations on the right would have an interest in doing it. We don't necessarily, though, when you think of Spirit in Place, Indiana Humanities, or even Presidential Library and Center, as spots where this would be a priority. So I want to talk a little bit about how this initiative came to be. I'm going to start with you, Aaron.
Yeah, well, you know, actually, it was about a year ago, year and a half ago, Leah and I were both at a meeting, and it was all about Indiana's civic health. And frankly, we'd been to a lot of meetings about Indiana's civic health and how poor it is. Just one example, the 2012 presidential election, Indiana was 38th in the nation in voter turnout. We have poor civic health. Well, at the end of this meeting, Leah and I literally huddled in a corner and we're like, okay, we're done talking. How do we and how do the organizations that we work for begin to try to move the needle on this? What are our assets? And our assets are people. We reach a lot of people. We work with a lot of different organizations. We have the ability to communicate in a nonpartisan fashion the importance of voting and also how you vote, where you vote, why you register to vote. We have the ability to do that, and we should. And that's really where it started.
Yeah, I think both of us were thinking about what's the low-hanging fruit here, right? We know our colleagues in the nonprofit space are really busy, and probably very few organizations have as their mission to vote, but a lot of organizations have as some part of their mission this idea of civic engagement, making their community better. And so we kind of thought, well, maybe we can challenge other nonprofit organizations to put their money or at least their time and resources, you know, other kinds of resources where their mouth is. If we all say we care about civic engagement, then why aren't we doing more to encourage our communities to be more civically engaged. So we decided to just have a luncheon. We invited some of our colleagues from organizations around Central Indiana, a lot of program directors, frankly. They're always good doers. Mm-hmm. And so we invited them to lunch and we said, let's just share some of the statistics about civic participation in Indiana. Let's kind of make it obvious. You know, with statistics like this, you can't assume that everyone on your staff votes. You can't assume that the parents of the kids that are dropped off in your daycare programs vote. You can't assume a lot of things about Indiana voters. And we wanted to share some ideas and resources about ways that other nonprofit organizations locally, and in a minute, I hope Charlie will talk about what they're doing, because that was one of the organizations we talked about, are doing at the Benjamin Harrison Presidential Site, but also nationally, and then point them towards actual resources designed to support nonprofit organizations as they engage in this work. We'll probably get into this, but a lot of nonprofits are very fearful that, you know, what's legal, what's not legal. I don't want to violate my nonprofit status. So we wanted to point them and help answer some questions about that.
Yeah, to simplify, you can educate, you can't endorse, basically.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think we're very committed to that as part of our organizations. Yeah. I mean, we here at Indiana Humanities feel very strongly, you know, we see our role as a convener, as an educator, but as nonpartisan. And so how can we kind of navigate within that to encourage Hoosiers to be more civically healthy?
So, Charlie, you've been set up here. How did the Benjamin Harrison Presidential Site get involved in this?
Well, you know, really, in our work, we've been involved in this space for a long time, but not necessarily in very public ways. Mm-hmm. So for us, it really started in fall of 2014 when we reached out to the city. We weren't serving as a polling site at the time, but wanted to offer ourselves as a location, as a polling site, and some confusion ensued. And initially, they thought we were trying to get out of being a polling site. And they said, well, nobody ever calls and offers
sort of
to
like,
be a polling
it's
site.
It's sort of like jury duty. Right?
Exactly, yeah. Okay. So no one ever calls and offers to be a polling site. So they were surprised and delighted when they got our call. And so in a relatively short time span, they were able to come out and look through the site and make sure that we could be certified as a polling site. And so it was really in the spring of 2015 that we first served as a polling site. And it was really eye-opening for us. How well-received it was that we were a polling site. And as we were having internal conversations and really working on a strategic plan that would be passed, December of 15, and more on that in a minute, mm-hmm. It became apparent to us that there was really a need in this space. Mm-hmm. And so it helped shape our thinking around how we can best serve the larger community, our Indianapolis community, being an organization that's nationally significant but locally relevant, mm-hmm. And making sure that we were engaging fully to our greatest strengths. And so doing something simple, you know, almost obvious, you know, why mm-hmm. wouldn't a presidential site serve as a polling site? But as we started talking to some of our peers and presidential sites, libraries across the country.
Are there any others that do it?
Here's the really strange thing. We can only find one other library, presidential library, that is currently serving as a polling site.
Which one?
Reagan. And my understanding is that it's in a fairly remote location, so it may be the only option. Not to say that it wouldn't be a fantastic polling site, but I'm not sure how they came to that decision. And for us, it was a very active, intentional decision, wanting to make sure that we could provide this service to our neighborhood immediately, but to our greater community, and perhaps set by example to our peers to look to engage in that way too.
Were you a polling site then for the primary?
So it was really interesting for us too, in that for the primary in 15, I think citywide turnout was in 8% range, and we saw over 10% turnout.
Okay.
For the fall of 15, I think citywide turnout was in the upper
20s. 22.7%.
Was it 22%? Oh, so even worse.
Okay.
And we were in, I think, the low 30s.
Okay.
For our precinct. And then for this spring, citywide was more in the...
Aaron, I think you're being cued here.
No, I think it was in the mid-30s. Yeah. I think it was in the mid-30s, and we saw over 50% turnout. So it kind of begs some questions, and it's causing us to really look into this more actively. You know, certainly that could be a reflection of our precinct, that they feel engaged in that process and want to vote. It also could speak to location
and
the welcoming environment that you present as an organization, so that people know that it's a place that they can feel welcome and safe.
And admittedly, I'm a history geek, but I would think that would be really, really cool, you know, to be able to cast your ballot. Yeah.
So I will say, I live in the district, and I actually vote at the Presidential Historic Site, and it is really cool. And I come from a background of museums, and so I was so thrilled to find out that I got to go vote at a museum, at a historic site that's associated with, you know, electoral history. Mm-hmm. You get a special sticker, so you don't just get the standard I voted with an American flag. You get a special I voted at the Presidential Historic Site sticker, which is just icing on the cake. Then I will also say, especially the primary, the line was not short, which is a good thing, actually, in Indiana. So I'll say to everyone, if you're in a long line, that's a good thing. Don't complain. But we got to be in a space where we could learn a little bit. You know, there's exhibits and photos and things on the walls. So it was a nice space to spend some time while you're waiting to vote. It was very inspiring.
If you're just joining us, we are talking about voter turnout, specifically a new civic challenge initiative coordinated by the good folks at Spirit and Place and Indiana Humanities. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. So we got this idea that we're bringing together all of these groups to do this. Simple question. I'm going to start with Leah on this one because I threw Aaron on the hot seat last time. What were you asking them to do?
That's a great, easy question. Yeah. Well, the first thing we asked ourselves is, what can we do, right? How can we be a resource? And so we had this luncheon to just kind of feel out our colleagues at different, you know, cultural organizations. And I think it started really with folks in kind of what I would call the humanities and arts kind of museum sort of space. So folks that are often, you know, we're not social service agencies and things like that,
but who have audiences and direct connection with the public on a regular basis.
Absolutely. And so we had this luncheon. People seemed really engaged. They were excited. They felt motivated. A lot of folks in the room committed right there and then. Yes, my organization is going to use the resources that we have in 2016 to encourage our community to more civically active. And then from there, we scheduled a couple of trainings. So we partnered with WFYI, who actually hosted us here. We did two trainings, one in the spring and then one over the summer, just about, you know, how do you register voters? What can nonprofits do? What can't they do? Even if you can do it, should you do it? Mm-hmm. And what kinds of conversations should you have as an organization before you decide to engage in that work? And that was an open call invitation. And we had wonderful.
Great turnout.
Yeah. Aaron, do you want to add anything?
So one of the things we did in the training was provide all of these nonprofits who are coming to us pre-scripted tweets and Facebook posts and e-newsletter pieces that they could use, all based on providing nonpartisan voter education to the public. So Indiana's voter registration deadline is October 11th, right? Mm-hmm. So we are encouraging our nonprofit partners who are already using social media to throw in some information about when election deadlines are coming up, where you could go for nonpartisan voter information. My volunteer background, I'm very active with the League of Women Voters. So when we were doing these trainings, we did sit people down and explain to them how to properly fill out a voter registration form and turn it in.
So basically the effort is educational. And I got to pick up here with Charlie, too, in terms of the presidential side, because it sounds like, do you remain open for business? I mean, can people come in then while you're doing this? Because I would think that would be kind of a cool outing is to.
We do. And what we find is that they have a full agenda for that day. So they're carving out that little bit of time to be able to get in their voting. And so we do have some people that think to visit the museum on election day. But for the most part, they're there to vote. And so for us, it's as much that opportunity just to get people engaged and get them excited about what they're doing, to thank them for spending their time in voting. And that's where we can see really providing that greatest value is making sure that people recognize that they're being recognized for committing their civic duty and contributing to the larger community in that way.
Is there a URL? A single URL associated with this initiative, or are you driving people to their various entry points?
There's no single URL, but we encourage everyone, organization or individuals listening, to go to indianavoters.com. That is a website that's run by the Secretary of State's office. It's where you can figure out, you can update or verify your voter registration status. You can confirm your polling location. You can just find a lot of really great nonpartisan basic electoral information that all of us should really be checking up on before we head to the polls on Election Day.
So you drive them to that site. What kind of messages, when you say with these coordinating, all of these coordinating groups, what kind of messages were you trying to push out in terms of educating or informing, Leah?
Well, to the nonprofits themselves, I think we wanted to educate them, like what is actually permissible behavior and what is not, and what kinds of questions you need to be aware of, and, you know, what kind of conversation you need to have with your board and executive director. To the actual public, we're talking about when do you need to register by, and making sure people know that you have to also check and make sure your address is correct. If you've moved or changed your name since the last deadline, you need to update your registration.
Well, and I think what's been so great through these conversations that we've been having is it's become apparent that these small actions have big implications. That, you know, for us as organizations, that it's not asking a lot of us to engage in these way or in this way, but it really has big implications in terms of our greater community.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about voter turnout, Spirit in Place, and Indiana Humanities are engaging in a civic challenge initiative to increase voter turnout and other standards of civic health. My guests are Aaron Kelly of Spirit in Place, Leah Namias of Indiana Humanities, and Charlie Hyde, who's with the Benjamin Harrison Presidential Site. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about voter turnout today on No Limits. In honor of a new civic challenge initiative pulled together by the good folks at Spirit in Place and Indiana Humanities, my guests are Aaron Kelly. She is program director for Spirit in Place. Leah Namias, she's Director of Programs and Community Engagement for Indiana Humanities, and Charlie Hyde, he is the President and CEO of the Benjamin Harrison Historic Presidential Site. Excuse me. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi, or you can do what a listener named Kelly has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Kelly, welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for having me.
Certainly.
I just had a question, I guess, about one of your guests talked about being able to go to a website and sort of educate yourself on some voter information. And I was wondering, in other states that I've lived and voted in, this is my fourth state, Indiana is my fourth state living and voting in, I've always had voter information packets mailed to my home that provides, you know, maybe backgrounds of things coming up on the ballot or people who are running for office. And so I was just wondering why maybe that has not been done here in Indiana and what it would take to have something like that done here in Indiana.
Good question. Thanks very much for the call and the question, Kelly. Aaron.
Yeah, so voter guides are a wonderful thing. One resource you might want to check out is vote411.org. This is a platform that's actually created by the League of Women Voters. It's up to each individual league chapter to populate it with information, so I can't say how robust it would necessarily be for all the races, but that's a resource you can use. A lot of the other information that seems to be sent out is controlled by the political parties. And I think you always want to take all of that with a grain of salt. We want you to be a savvy voter, so we want you to be very critical and analytical of those materials that come to you. But the best thing that I can suggest doing is looking for nonpartisan resources. So reach out to organizations that have a nonpartisan background, go to their websites, research what they have done. As for particular mailings, shameless plug here, join one of those nonpartisan organizations and be one of those volunteer leaders that helps create those materials, because oftentimes these materials are created by volunteers who are doing this work out of a sense of civic duty.
We've gotten a Facebook message from a listener named Janet, and if you'd like to reach out to us by Facebook, you can find us at No Limits WFYI. Janet asks, what impact has Indiana's voter ID laws had on voter turnout? Should the law be changed to be less restrictive? Everybody's avoiding eye contact. I feel like I'm teaching a class right now. Leah, I'm going to go with you.
Well, I don't know the exact statistics, and Aaron may be able to help us with that. And I have to say, as someone who works for a nonpartisan organization, I can't really advocate one particular political position about whether it should be repealed or not. I do think it's incumbent on all of us to – Aaron's nodding her head and says I should, so I'll let her talk in a minute. Okay. I do think it's really incumbent on us, though, to be asking these kind of questions and trying to learn as much information. And I think in addition to our elected officials, we have a role to play with our media sources to make sure that they're driving this conversation forward. Aaron, do you want to add anything there?
You know, I will just say I think that there are a lot of things that can be done in the state of Indiana to encourage voter participation. And I'm speaking now as a member of the League of Women Voters.
Okay.
I do not believe that the voter ID law really helps encourage participation. I think it sets up unneeded barriers. And I do believe that organizations, once they have buy-ins of their boards and their staff and others, should talk more about these kinds of issues. There's a difference between advocacy and lobbying. Mm-hmm. And talking about issues and what they mean for the community is a form of advocacy that I think more groups need to step into and talk about.
Gotten a tweet from a listener named Clyde. You can find us on Twitter at WFYI. He says, how can you have engaged citizens when they are educated inside classrooms utilizing rewards, punishments, and authoritarianism? Educational experience in Indiana is designed to produce workers and consumers, not informed voters. Charlie.
Well, I think that's a good question. And certainly, I think a lot of schools rely upon their community partners, museums, other educators to help make sure that their students are fully informed to the extent they can. And an organization like ours, we really focus on that civic engagement piece and making sure that students know their history better. I know that Benjamin Harrison is part of state standards for Indiana, and certainly it's one of the things that informs our programs. We have school programs for grade school, middle school, and for high school. We have special programs like Future Presidents of America, which is a youth leadership camp, and really utilizing those as tools to help ensure that students come to better understand those responsibilities and obligations that they have as a citizen. One of the quotes that Benjamin Harrison said that really informs our work is he said, an American citizen could not be a good citizen who did not have a hope in his heart. And I think that's true. And especially in an election year like this, where not everyone has hope in their heart, you know, certainly giving full thought to what those obligations are for you as a citizen and how you have to weigh out these issues and help determine what's best for the greater community.
And I'll just add, as a former U.S. history teacher, that teachers work really well within the constraints that they have, which is a curriculum that they may mm-hmm. not be fully in charge of. I think social studies teachers are some of the greatest advocates for civic participation you'll ever meet. And I want to thank all the teachers who, you know, get a lot of eye rolls from their students until it's an election year when they talk about these issues.
Well, and you see how important those teachers are in terms of students being able to learn the material they
right.
need to.
Do the students, you know, who come to, say, the Benjamin Harrison presidential site, the home, grasp that the past was every bit as vibrant and confused
well,
as the present? I mean, particularly when you're talking about Benjamin Harrison, I mean, the Harrison-Cleveland races, and there were two of them, were some of the most contentious in America's history. And there was an awful lot of no-holds-barred politicking in those races as well. That it definitely not every shot was above the belt.
Well, and we think about it in terms of looking back and thinking forward. Mm. This idea that you can look to history to help inform some of the decisions that you make today. And when we're doing our job well, which I think we certainly are, we have a very strong education team. We're using programs like A Pledge is a Promise, getting students to think about the way that the actions that were taken by the signers, for example, how those have implications for us even yet today. Mm-hmm. And so this idea of political decisions somehow being apart or different than the rest of our lives just isn't true. That really the decisions that are made by our government impact us in many cases for generations. Mm-hmm. And so it does have a greater impact and having that better understanding, especially being able to do that from the home of a president. So the only president elected from Indiana, being able to be in that space where history was truly made, where Harrison gave more than 80 speeches to more than 300,000 people from the front steps of that house, where he received news of the nomination for the presidency right there in the back parlor. It makes all the difference, and we have really strong education teams, strong docents, great teacher partnerships that allow us to do that.
Well, and I'll just add that one of the things that historic sites and museums and the humanities, I would say more generally, can really do is make sure people understand that this is not the first election where Americans have disagreed about what the future of the country looks like is, that they, you know, wrestled with big questions and debated, and you're right, they were sometimes really nasty in their politicking too, and I think that actually is really fun to teach, you know, to kids. They get really excited about that. The worst tendency that we have is to assume that nothing like this has ever happened before. And I think for students in particular, to assume that, you know, the outcome was always foreordained and that people living in the moment, you know, we have to remind them didn't know what was going to happen. And so when people might ask, like, why would a historic site even do this work, is to actually take us to that moment and look at those primary source documents, that historic information, and kind of think about how and learn about how people in the past debated.
Well, and I'm thinking with the Cleveland and Harrison thing, I mean, Grover Cleveland ran for president 3 times because, and he's the only president in American history to have two different presidencies, because he was interrupted by Harrison's term. And we tend to think that somehow character questions and a lot of the unseemliness of our current political debates are somehow new. But in Cleveland's case, you know, even the cliche that is in a lot of the history books, that he fathered a child out of wedlock, actually is a relatively sanitized version of what went on. Am I not correct, Charlie?
Yeah, that's very fair. In fact, a shameless plug. We have a program this Friday morning. We have a first Friday program, and it's called Coffee with a Curator.
Yeah.
And the theme for this Friday is character and caricature. Mm-hmm. And so looking very much at that idea of the public persona of somebody or how they actually are versus the way that they were portrayed. And so we'll be exploring that a little bit more in depth. But yeah, that program is this Friday morning at 8:30, just 8:30 to 9. It's just really short and sweet and to the point.
And so we don't leave people hanging.
Sure.
The story with Cleveland isn't just, we don't know for sure whether he fathered a child out of wedlock, because he and a group of Buffalo businessmen were in effect, they formed a sort of mini conglomerate to support a single mistress that they all shared. He agreed. Yeah, it's really, really unseemly stuff. He agreed to acknowledge fatherhood of the woman's child because he was the only one of them who was not married. If you're just joining us, we are talking about increasing voter turnout here on No Limits. The Hook is a new initiative to promote civic engagement by the good folks at Spirit and Place and Indiana Humanities. If you'd like to join the conversation, please send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, on Twitter at wfyi. Or you can do what a listener named Mary Lynn has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Mary Lynn, welcome to the program.
Well, I'm a green card holder. I have been told that I can vote in local elections, but not federal elections. And I looked at websites that will tell me that. But then when I go to the official website for voters, it only says that you have to be a U.S. citizen. So I'm a little confused whether I have been told correctly or not. And I'm thinking if people with green cards could vote in local elections, you'd get more people out to vote.
Thanks very much for the call and the question. We'll see if we can get an answer for you.
Sure. So to vote in a U.S. federal election, you have to be a U.S. citizen. And in Indiana, you also have to be a U.S. citizen to vote in any state and local races. I do believe that there are some states that have municipalities that allow green card voters or green card residents to vote. But those are in local elections and not in Indiana. In Indiana, to vote in any election, you have to be a U.S. citizen.
What are some of the other misconceptions about who's eligible to vote and who's not eligible to vote?
felons can vote. That is a huge myth that felons cannot vote. Felons absolutely can. You simply cannot be imprisoned. But once you're out of prison, you can vote. There's also a common misconception that people have to re-register to vote every time, and that is not true. You do have to update your voter registration if you have moved or changed your name. But you don't have to re-register every time you vote. And I think there is some growing confusion in Indiana about where to vote. Some communities have what are known as vote centers, where you can just, no matter where you live in that community, you go to a vote center. Here in Marion County, we still have precinct-based voting. So you have to go to your assigned precinct in order to vote.
Is there, out of this initiative, because you've been engaging in these conversations about why people vote, why they don't vote. Have you heard what some of the obstacles people say are? I mean, we got a question, obviously, about the voter ID laws and some of the other things, but are there other, what are the common reasons people say they don't vote? I'm going to start with Leah, and then I'll give everyone a whack at this.
Okay, so everyone has a whack at this.
Yes.
One thing that I hear a lot is just how early our polls close. So, and I will speak as someone who's a native Hoosier but lived out of state and voted out of state a long time. I thought it was really normal that polls closed at 6 p.m. until I lived anywhere else, and I realized it's really abnormal. So that's a really big one for people who have family commitments, people who are working, people who have, you know, work third shift or something like that. So, and that's one of those things that, you know, if you haven't ever lived or voted outside of Indiana, you might not realize is up to the states. It's up to the clerks essentially to decide how long to keep their polls open.
Charlie.
You know, it's been really interesting for us because we've had kind of a crash course lesson, just having one-on-one conversations with people in our precinct, just sharing their thoughts with us as they come and vote. And one of the things that we've heard again and again is the convenience of the location for voting, the how welcoming it is. You know, certainly through the certification process, those things are considered. But being able to have a voting site, a polling site that's adjacent or within your precinct is important to a lot of people because it makes it so much easier to vote. There's less uncertainty. I think certainly we heard in the primary that there were some instances in which people were confused where the polling site had moved to and it was on different sides of a building. And I mean, those are things that should be avoidable. And I know that our public officials are working hard to make sure that those things don't ever happen. But we want to do what we can as an organization and certainly influence our peers, again, to serve as polling sites to the extent they can. So it's one of the things that we've taken upon as part of this larger initiative, that we're proud to be a polling site. It's something that no organization should ever see this as being a burden or as being something that they would want to try to get out of. You know, certainly there are individual reasons why it could be a challenge for an organization to serve in this capacity. But, you know, you think about the larger role that we play, especially as not-for-profits in our communities, and it's something simple that we can do that has, you know, large consequences.
Aaron.
I've worked as a poll worker for a number of years in my precinct and others, and it always amazes me how many people will come to the polls with every intention to vote, and their name won't be in the poll book. And that's usually because they have moved or changed their name and didn't realize that they needed to update their voter registration status. Complicating that, too, is that Indiana has one of the largest voter registration periods in the nation at 29 days. So it's difficult sometimes for voters to update that status.
So those are the obstacles, is that there aren't as much access. I mean, is there any thought, you know, for example, and I'm just going to toss something out here. I'm, as I've said, geeking out at the prospect of voting at a presidential historic site, I would be willing to pay a small premium to be able to do something like that rather than voting
taxes,
at the local.
No pardon? Poll taxes. No poll taxes.
No, not that. But, you know, something that is like that. Are there ways that we're considering incentivizing voting or...
Well, you have to be careful with that.
I know.
Get in trouble with election law if you incentivize voting. But I think in all of our organizations, I mean, we're trying to help create a culture of civic participation. And one of the things I think we're all trying to do is stay positive, because we absolutely know that positive messaging drives people to the polls more than negative messaging.
And so I'll just give an example of kind of culture of voting that one of my coworkers told me about. She used to work in a law firm, and a senior senior partner in the law firm would just bring in donuts on election day. And if you had an I voted sticker, you got to have a donut. And that's like kind of the small, not necessarily an incentive, but that is rewarding a culture of voting and kind of saying it's cool and special and kind of a thank you. And that was very informal, right? That was within an organization.
I would be more than happy to buy the governor donuts if he would let me vote at the Benjamin Harrison presidential site. If you're just joining us, we are talking about voter turnout here on No Limits. My guests are Aaron Kelly of Spirit and Place, Leah Namias of Indiana Humanities, and Charlie Hyde of the Benjamin Harrison Presidential Site. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about voter turnout. The good folks at Spirit and Place and Indiana Humanities have worked with and pulled together other not-for-profits in a project to increase voter turnout and increase civic engagement. My guests are Aaron Kelly. She is program director for Spirit and Place. Leah Namias, she's director of programs and community engagement for Indiana Humanities. And Charlie Hyde, he's president and CEO of the Benjamin Harrison Presidential Site, which, as I've probably expressed during the show, is probably the coolest polling place now in Indianapolis. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, or you can do what a listener has done and reach out to us via Twitter and find us at WFYI. This listener says, "Why was my son allowed to work the polls but not vote because he forgot his license and couldn't leave the polls to go home and get it?" Aaron.
Because that's Indiana state law. I mean, there's no other answer to give. That's the state law. In Marion County, we do allow 16 and 17-year-olds to work at a polling location. But regardless where you are in the state, if you have signed the poll book before showing your ID, which a poll worker should never allow you to do, but if that's the situation that's happened, you're not allowed to leave, get your ID, and come back and vote.
You're not allowed to leave in those circumstances. So
correct, yeah.
What problem are they trying to solve with that? Yeah, these grand gestures don't work.
I would assume they're trying to prevent the idea that one person would go and vote in multiple locations or multiple times throughout the day. I mean, that problem is not necessarily as widespread as the solutions that we've come up with.
But since it's precinct-based, though, there's only one precinct I can vote in, and since I have to produce a state-issued picture ID.
Yeah, and then...
Yeah,
because we are precinct-based, your name is only on one poll book at one location.
Yes.
So I am not entirely sure how this helps prevent in-person voter fraud.
Okay. We are talking about promoting voter turnout here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Allison has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Allison, welcome to the program.
Thanks.
Certainly.
I have a question regarding primaries, which I think voter turnout for those are even less. I have lived in the state for 30 years, and I've been in public service for a good part of my career. And it was always the perception among public employees that if you went to a primary and voted for a certain party, that your boss, i.e. the government, could come and know which party you voted for, and that could then jeopardize your job, particularly if there was a change in administration. And I've been shocked. Later on in my career, wasn't so sensitive around politicians. They weren't quite so playing a role in my career. And I found myself voting in the 2008 primary and the 2010 primary and walked in and one time asked for one party's ballot and the next time asked for the other party's ballot, and nobody seemed to be noting anywhere that I had taken a certain ballot. And I think there's a lot of public servants in the state who believe that they just can't vote in a primary because then their political beliefs would be revealed to their employers. Has that been an issue discussed at all?
Not in this program. Thanks very much for the call and the question, Allison.
Uh-huh.
Certainly. Aaron.
I think that's a legitimate concern. Indiana has a primary system that makes you, you have to ask for either a Democrat or Republican ballot. And I think when we talk about things that disincentivize voting, mm-hmm. that's one of them. There are a lot of people who don't identify strongly with one party or another, and they don't like polling one ballot. And there are individuals like this person who have concerns. I personally don't know how easy it is for government employees to check and see what kind of ballot you've pulled in a primary. So I cannot speak to that. But
if anyone would have access to that information, though, it would be those folks.
Yeah.
So.
Although I do thank the caller for just calling in and kind of saying her own experience of not necessarily feeling like it, even though she'd felt like for 25 years it was a scary thing to do.
We have gotten a message from a listener on Facebook. And again, if you want to reach out to us via Facebook, you can find us at No Limits WFYI. This is from Lisa. She says, Hamilton County will have multiple locations this year for early voting because so many people in our county choose to vote early. In addition to the Hamilton County Courthouse, anyone in Hamilton County can vote at the Carmel Clay Public Library, as well as a location in Fishers.
Great. Thank you for sharing. That's great to know.
Well, and that's part of, I'm presuming, what you wanted to do with this initiative is to have information sharing across the lines.
Yeah, and I would say in some way we're modeling right now on air something that Hoosiers actually don't do very well. So according to the Civic Health Index, which is a report that not only compiles things like voter registration and voter turnout, it compiles things like, do you talk to your neighbors about voting? Do you talk to your neighbors about politics? And Hoosiers, not surprisingly, when you look at our voter turnout, I would say we don't do that very well. I think there's a Midwestern politeness that prevents us from really just saying things out loud. And so this kind of neighborly way of saying, make sure you know that you can early vote here, and talking about those kinds of experiences is a really important component of civic health. It's not just about whether people show up to the polls.
We're talking about voter turnout here on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what Susan has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Susan, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon. I want to thank your guests for trying to promote a culture of civic engagement. I think that's a wonderful objective, and I wish them well in that. I also would ask them to try to help the voters understand that in Indiana, when we register, we do not register as Republicans or Democrats or Independents. They may have heard of George Will changing his registration so he's no longer a registered Republican wherever it is he lives. In Indiana, we register as voters. So they are, yes, in a primary, you have to call for a ballot for a particular party, as one of the previous callers was talking about. But we do not register by party. That's my comment. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for the call and the comment. That is, in fact, Charlie, you wanted to say something?
Well, I was just going to say it's important, and as Leah mentioned, you know, this idea of having conversations. It's maybe this lost art of having discourse, the idea that you have genial conversations about ideas of great significance. And I think that we've seen our governor's race be very civil in this respect, maybe on the federal level,
less so in other areas.
But that really also goes a long way in creating this culture of engagement, of civic engagement.
And I should say the phone banks have completely lit up here, so I'm going to ask our callers to be brief in their questions, concise if they can, and also our guests. I want to try to get as many people in as possible. Anne, you're on the air.
Yes, I had a question about being a felon and being able to vote or not. Could you clarify that again? And that was my question.
Thanks very much for the call and the question and for being brief.
Felons can vote. If you are in prison, you cannot vote. But after you've served your time, you can vote. You may have to re-register, but felons can vote in the state of Indiana.
And Aaron, what if you're on parole or you have a bracelet or anything like that around your ankle? Can
you are not imprisoned, so therefore
you can. So you can still vote, provided the bracelet
allows
you to go far enough.
I'm not 100% sure on the bracelet, but I know if you're pending trial, you're still allowed to vote.
We are talking about voter turnout here on No Limits. Kimberly, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you today?
Doing well. How about you?
Question.
Sure.
About the propositions that are going to be on the ballot, and how are they getting out to the public? Because a lot of times you walk into the polling and see it on the ballot, and they give you a short sentence and say, vote yes or no. And it's like you don't know what it is, and everybody does not have a computer to go look for this stuff. So how are they getting that out to the public about what's going on with those propositions? Thanks. I'll listen to your answer on the call.
Thank you very much. Certainly. Aaron.
Well, you have the proponents and the opponents of any sort of ballot measure out there who are trying to spread their word. In terms of how they do it, you'd really have to connect with those individuals. I know the transit folks, I think, have some printed pieces coming up. They've got some events that are going on. As I understand it, there's a ballot measure about whether or not you should have a constitutional right to hunt and fish. I'm still trying to figure out information on that one. It takes homework on the part of voters.
I think that's one of the things that is really important. I think that comes up a lot, right? Like, what is the responsibility of the government or elected officials to put out this kind of information versus voters? And I think part of what we're saying is that voters have to seek out this information. And if they don't have access to a computer, you know, go to the library, go find places where you can get access to information.
Is there a role for a not-for-profit, and obviously Women Voters would be one, to do more in this area in terms of public voter education on the issues? Because I work in and around politics an awful lot, and it's not uncommon for me to get calls, emails from people as an election day rolls up saying, I know who I want to vote for president, governor, senator, and all. But a lot of these down ticket races or these other issues, can you just tell me what they're about? And it seems to me that there is a hunger for knowing in just relatively concise form what is at stake there. Charlie, you're nodding your head, so I'm going to go.
It's just, it's one of the obligations of being an informed citizen. It's just making sure that you're looking for those opportunities. There are lots of advocacy groups, pro and con, pretty much any issue you can come up against. And so look in your local paper, look for local flyers, look online. If you don't have access to a computer, certainly libraries are fantastic resources.
And I would say that organizations can also take on an issue and produce material that educates. So mm-hmm. An example of an organization that I am a part of is IndyCog, which is a bicycle advocacy yeah. organization. And they produce kind of a little one sheet about, where do all of the mayoral candidates in 2015 stand on access to, bike trails and other kind of bike related issues. So that's a really key example, especially for those down ballot races where you may not know very much. I think organizations, especially if they have a mission that aligns to particular issues on the ballot, they absolutely have a role. And we've seen that a lot with transit. So we've seen a lot of really interesting organizations from the Chamber of Commerce to IndyHub, which is a young professional organization, to a lot of organizations that work on social services kind of, coming together to do some voter education around that particular ballot initiative.
We're talking about voter turnout and a new civic challenge to promote civic engagement and civic health. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can do what Dee has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Dee, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon. Here is my question. What is being done to improve voter access for persons with disabilities, especially in the area of having privacy to vote? And I will take my answer off air.
Thanks very much for the call and the question.
That is a great question. I'm very happy to say that Indiana Disability Rights is one of the organizations that we've been talking to. And I know they're doing a lot of work to help make sure those with disabilities have full access at the polls. There are laws in place regarding the fact that polling sites should be ADA accessible. And a lot of this goes back to poll worker training and helping the county clerks understand how to properly train their poll workers so that those with disabilities are shown the respect that they deserve at the polls.
And I'll add that the Indiana Disability Rights has put together some great videos that are all accessible. So you can, if you have different kinds of like hearing or sight disabilities, they're still accessible with this kind of voter information. I think it's also really incumbent on voters to know what their rights are and to be their own best advocate when they can.
Marjorie, welcome to the program.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Certainly.
Since we're talking about voter turnout, I just wondered why our polls close at 6 p.m. I just recently learned that there are only two other states that close their polls this early. And with all the working people and the huge lines we usually have at 6 p.m., I'm thinking it would be helpful to have a longer opening time, closing.
We'll try to get an answer for you. Thanks very much for the call and the question.
Yeah, this is a great example of where you as a private citizen can have some impact. I would say contact your legislators in the General Assembly and let them know that you think this way. I mean, that's part of civic participation, civic engagement as well. It's not only voting, it's continually letting your elected officials know how you feel about these things.
But the short answer is it's 6 p.m. Yep. because the legislature has said it's 6 yep. p.m. and there's no reason that that can't change because legislatures have that power.
Absolutely. Well, and it was a product, as we say, of a much earlier time. I mean, it's like the old joke in the days when, well, I guess we're still on two different time zones in many parts of the state, even though we were supposed to have solved that, of the flight attendant who, when they landed, said, you know, you've just landed in Indianapolis, set your watch back, you know, 1 hour or 25 years, whichever you prefer. So we are talking about voter turnout here. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can send us an email, as a listener named Amy has done. And our email address is nolimits@wfyi.org. Many states offer same-day registration, but Indiana still has the 30-day deadline. With all the technology advances, it seems that clerk's offices in our 92 counties could process them more efficiently without needing 30 days. Response, I've been picking on Aaron, so I'm going to go to Leah on this one first.
I mean, I think I would say the same thing Aaron would. I mean, I agree. Like, I think that this is something that could change, but it takes the legislature and it takes people raising this as an issue that's important. And it was shocking to me to learn that Indiana has the longest lag time in the country between when you have to register to vote and poll and the election day. And I have to think that that's one of the reasons our turnout is lower.
I'm going to try. We're getting very tight on time. I'm going to try to squeeze in one more call. Bianca, welcome to the program.
Hi there. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Certainly. We are getting tight on time, so please be quick.
Sure. I just moved to Hamilton County from Tippecanoe County, where they have had for several election cycles early voting and voting centers, which are awesome. You can vote at your grocery store. They bring the voting centers to nursing homes and to the Indiana veterans' homes. It was very convenient as a working parent. That piggybacks off the last caller's question about why do they close at 6. Why can't we implement that system in all of Indiana counties and make it so much easier for folks to vote? I'll take my answer offline. Thank you.
Thanks very much for the call, Bianca.
Well, first off, I do want to clarify that throughout Indiana, in all counties, there is early voting. Now, the county clerks have discretion on what those hours are and what days and what weekends. But if you cannot make it to the polls on Election Day, please contact your local county clerk to find out about your early voting options in your county. You can do that at the City County Building here in Marion County. In terms of the vote centers, logistically, those are challenging, and the state legislature has certain rules about where they can be.
So we're getting real close on time here, but if you're not sure about whether you are registered to vote, what is the deadline to figure that out?
October 11th.
October 11th and Election Day again. I'm going to ask you to do this in unison. Is what day?
November 8th.
November 8th. Thank you. I really enjoyed talking with the three of you, and I'm very grateful that you came in here today. I'd like to thank my guests, Aaron Kelly of Spirit and Place, Leah Namias of Indiana Humanities, and Charlie Hyde with the Benjamin Harrison Presidential Site. And I'd also like to thank our listeners for some really, really great questions. This was a very fun show, and I am grateful to you for taking part. I am John Kroll. You have been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive Producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Terzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.